You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Welcome to this episode of the Daily Vet Life Podcast, where we chat with equine veterinarians about the cases they've worked on in their clinics. I'm your host, Alex Beckstedt, Editorial Director of Equimanagement, and today I'm speaking with Dr. Elizabeth Acutt about using PET scan to investigate a challenging lameness case. This episode of the Daily Vet Life Podcast is brought to you by DECRA. Dr. Acutt obtained her veterinary degree from the University of Bristol, United Kingdom. She then traveled to the University of California, Davis, to undergo additional training in her areas of interest, which are equine orthopedics and sports medicine. She was the first person to complete a residency specifically in equine diagnostic imaging, based at Colorado State University, and became a diplomat of the American College of Veterinary Radiologists in 2022. She remained at CSU following her residency in the role of Senior Fellow in Veterinary Diagnostic Imaging. Dr. Acutt's clinical and research interests focus on comparative imaging in the equine athlete. She joined the faculty at Penn Vet in May 2023. Thank you, Dr. Acutt, for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's start at the beginning with this case that you're sharing with us today. Can you start by just telling us a little bit about the patient and how this horse first presented, and then we'll go from there?
Yeah, absolutely. And I will preface this by saying that, you know, as Alex mentioned during the introduction, I am a radiologist. I'm not a veterinarian working in the field. And so this case, and like most of my cases, is one that was worked up mostly by someone else and then the images sent for me to look at. So I'm going to give sort of a fairly brief description of the case, and it's going to be mostly a focus on the imaging findings for this one.
Great.
So this is a case, it's a quarter horse, 16-year-old quarter horse gelding. I'm going to call him Sinbad. That's not his name, but we'll give him a little anonymity pseudonym. And he presented with a grade 3 out of 5 right hind limb lameness. And the referring veterinarian worked this up with local analgesic blocks, and they blocked this lameness out to a subtarsal block. And so I have a few little talking points about this case, which I think are interesting. And the first one of those kind of hits on that blocking pattern. And so when we talk about horses blocking to the subtarsal region or doing a subtarsal block, that can mean a few different things to different people, right? So our options for those kinds of blocks are we can do like a high 4-point block. We can do just a general infiltration of that proximal suspensory region and sort of flood the area with local anesthetic. Or we can do the deep branch of the lateral plantar nerve block, which is probably the one that most people reach for. And so I'm not 100% sure exactly which of those blocks Sinbad had, but the thing that is interesting and relevant to all of those is that there's more and more research coming out that, sadly, even though we rely on our blocks for localizing lameness, they might not be quite as accurate as we would hope that they would be. So there was a study that was performed by a group at Colorado State University in 2015, and they used positive contrast and radiographs to document diffusion of local anesthetic after we do some of these blocks. So they were specifically looking at the deep branch of the lateral plantar nerve and what happens when we inject that nerve and how far does our block spread beyond where we might want it to. And so they found that this block could diffuse on average about 2 centimeters proximal and up to 5 centimeters distal to where we place our needle. And then what they also found, they actually sampled some of the joints of the distal tarsus. So they sampled the tarsometatarsal joint after blocking. And they found that in 25% of limbs, they had evidence of enough block within those joints to also anesthetize those joints as well as that proximal metatarsal region. So just kind of really interesting for us to keep that in mind, that perhaps when we block that area, we might be blocking other things as well. And so another study also done by CSU, they published in 2018, where they kind of took it this step farther and they actually looked at what are the findings that we see on MRI in these horses when we do these blocks. And they found that in almost 50% of horses that responded to analgesia of the proximal suspensory ligament, these horses actually had more severe lesions in the distal tarsus. So almost like a 50-50 flip of a coin chance, right? Of like whether when you do that block and the horse gets better, your lameness is going to be in that proximal suspensory region or it's going to be in that distal tarsal region.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of take home message from that is just that, you know, these subtarsal blocks are not very specific, and a horse that blocks to the deep branch of the lateral plantar nerve, which we're kind of all told in vet school, oh, that's the nerve that supplies the proximal suspensory ligament. You know, you get that. That's what you're getting. Actually, that lameness could be originating from anywhere in the proximal metatarsal and or the distal tarsal region. So that's just kind of an interesting observation. And so if we take that back to our case of Sinbad, we have this horse which blocks to its proximal suspensory region, you know, plus or minus whatever else, via the subtarsal block. And so what should our next diagnostic step be? And so the veterinarian in this case decided very reasonably to do an ultrasound of that proximal suspensory ligament as kind of a first step and to see whether there was evidence of injury to that structure. And what they did see was some enlargement of that proximal suspensory ligament and also some fiber heterogeneity in that region. So at this point, kind of have a nice story, right? You know, the horse blocks to this region. We have some abnormalities on our ultrasound. So what they did was went ahead and rested the horse for 30 days, kind of thinking, you know, in general, soft tissue injuries tend to respond well to a little bit of a decreased exercise regime, a little bit of rest and rehab. But unfortunately, his lameness didn't really improve. So at this point, again, this is kind of where we go back to our knowledge of the blocking and think, okay, well, is there something else going on here that we might be missing? And so knowing that this blocking pattern might also reach other sources of lameness in this region, the vet actually referred the horse in for a CT of its proximal metatarsus and its tarsus region to kind of give a global assessment.
Calling all equine veterinarians. Are you tired of feeling like you're on an island when it comes to caring for your patients? Decra Veterinary Products is here to bridge that gap. They understand the challenges you face. That's why they offer a comprehensive line of high-quality products like Zycosan and Osphos, and empower you to offer your patients cutting-edge therapies like ProVet APC. They're not just a supplier, though. Decra provides ongoing training and support to help you stay ahead of the curve and deliver the best possible care. Visit www.decra-us.com to discover how Decra can be your partner in equine health.
When the horse went for a CT scan, that was the first time that I interacted with this horse. And what we saw on CT was really interesting. So the horse actually had moderate to severe osteoarthritis of its tarsometatarsal joint, and that was associated with quite a lot of lysis and bone loss within that joint space. And so now, you know, we're left with this horse where we have both proximal suspensory abnormalities on ultrasound and tarsometatarsal joint abnormalities on CT. And so the next question that we're kind of asking ourselves is, which of these is the primary contributor towards the horse's lameness? And so that can be a really difficult puzzle to figure out. And so some of the things that can happen, and again, I'm not usually the person doing these things out in the field, but some of our wonderful referring veterinarians will maybe repeat some of the blocking and try and do some slightly more specific blocks. So you might kind of try and block that joint, that tarsometatarsal joint directly, and see if that gives you more or less of a response to when you did that proximal suspensory block. So that can definitely give us a little bit of extra information. But the thing we kind of keep bumping up against is these blocks still aren't super specific. And again, those structures are so close to each other. The proximal suspensory and the tarsometatarsal joint are, you know, centimeters away from each other. So there's still the potential for that kind of crossover.
Right.
And so another option would be to just treat the horse and see what happens. You know, trial treatment is definitely very reasonable. And certainly that's what some owners want, you know, is like, let's do something and see what happens and see if we can help the horse. And so we've already tried rest in Sinbad, didn't really do much for us. We now have this finding of bony change on CT within that joint. So you could try treating that joint. If that hadn't been done already, you could put some steroid in there or a biologic product and see if maybe that gave some more improvement. You could also at that point kind of throw some extra stuff in for the proximal suspensory region, like maybe think about using some shockwave or something like that. Or if you wanted to kind of try and use your trial treatment also as a diagnostic, you could just kind of do a more stepwise approach and say, okay, let's just do the joint. Let's see if what improvement we get. And then that might make us feel more confident that one or the other is the problem. So I think that's a really reasonable approach, especially if you have a case where there are maybe financial limitations or you're limited in what advanced diagnostics are available to you regionally. That's definitely a perfectly reasonable option. And then another option is kind of what you alluded to at the start of the podcast, which is using a PET scan. And so PET scan is a type of functional imaging modality. And we might utilize that in this case to give us a little bit of extra information about the kind of activity of these two injuries. And that might save the owners some time in figuring out which is the primary issue and just let those horses get back to work more quickly. Mm-hmm. And so for some owners who are kind of, you know, really motivated by the diagnostics, really want to get to the bottom of it ASAP, then this can be a really nice option. And so just to kind of give an overview of PET, PET stands for positron emission tomography. And so this is a modality which is not the newest, but it's definitely expanding and growing a lot within sort of the last 5 or 10 years. And basically, PET uses radioactive tracers to determine how active certain lesions are, kind of similar to the way that we use radioactivity in bone scans or nuclear scintigraphy. So it's a little bit similar to that. The main difference being that PET scan is a three-dimensional cross-sectional modality. So it has sort of the functional information of bone scan, but it puts it into three dimensions for us. And so PET is to bone scan what like CT is to radiographs.
Right.
And so the PET scan also has the benefit of we can use a few different radio tracers when we do our PET scan. And so the first one of these is called sodium fluoride or NAF. And this is a bone tracer which binds to regions of increased bone turnover. So that's quite similar to how we use technetium in bone scan, where that tracer is taken up by areas of bone that's modeling and kind of gives us a little sentinel of like, hey, this is an area that is active, there's changes going on, you know, this might be something to pay attention to. And then our second tracer is called fluorodeoxyglucose or FDG. And this is actually a soft tissue tracer. So this is kind of, again, where we get a little bit more information from PET than bone scan, because we have this tracer that is specific to soft tissue. And how it works is that it's concentrated in areas of increased glucose utilization. And so usually those are areas of inflammation where there's like increased blood flow to an area and kind of increased glucose being utilized as part of that kind of inflammatory healing process. And so what that means is that we can use the combination of those two tracers to give us both bone and soft tissue information within the horse's leg in three dimensions. And so again, if we take this back to our case of Sinbad, we can use this modality here because we have these multiple lesions present, one in the bone, one in the soft tissue, and we're trying to decide which of these is more clinically relevant. And so in Sinbad's case, when we looked at the scan utilizing the bone tracer, we saw that there was a lot of increased uptake of the NAF, that bone tracer, in the regions of that subchondral bone loss in the tarsometatarsal joint that we had seen on the CT scan. So that was really interesting. That tells us like, hey, this is an active lesion. The bone is actively remodeling, you know, like pay attention to this area, basically. Mm-hmm. And on kind of the converse side, we actually did not see significantly increased uptake of FDG, our soft tissue tracer, in association with those proximal suspensory ligament changes that had been seen on ultrasound. So that might indicate that perhaps these changes are chronic. We know that when we have an injury to the proximal suspensory ligament, it kind of never really goes back to a totally normal appearance on ultrasound. So, you know, maybe he did a little something to his suspensory a while ago. He's healed from that. It's quiescent. And we're not seeing evidence of that being kind of actively inflamed on our PET scan. And so we can use that information basically just to increase our confidence that probably the primary lameness-causing injury for this horse right now is that tarsometatarsal joint osteoarthritis, even though the lameness originally localized to below the tarsus and the fact that there were those mild changes on the ultrasound.
So, like, armed with that information, do you just provide basically your findings and your opinions to the referring vet and then they go back to their client with the treatment and management recommendations? Or are you involved in some of the treatment recommendations as well?
That's a great question. It's a little bit dependent on the preferences of the referring veterinarian. Some of them, you know, really want some of that extra input and, you know, kind of say like, hey, especially with a newer modality like PET, they might say, well, what's your experience with these types of injuries? What do you think, you know, what would your recommendations be? Whereas other vets feel, you know, pretty confident. They just want that information and then they'll make decisions about treatment and recommend prognosis and things like that. So we can really be as involved or uninvolved in that process as people want us to be.
Yeah, that makes sense. So what do you know, if anything, about this horse's management and follow-up or recovery, if anything?
Yeah, so this is a great point. And again, this is where I fall a little bit of the hurdle of being in my referral center where I don't get to kind of see the horse for a lot of follow-up. I believe this horse had its tarsometatarsal joint treated and that it initially responded quite well. I don't have any long-term follow-up. He certainly had a decent amount of lysis, which might have meant that eventually he kind of got to the point where he was a candidate either for potentially surgery to fuse that joint, or that maybe that joint would have remodeled to the point that it started to fuse itself. But I didn't actually get the opportunity to follow him out that far.
Right. What does the availability and cost look like for this sort of advanced imaging for horse owners and referring vets?
That's certainly a limitation for sure.
Yeah.
So I have a map in front of me of where all the PET scanners are.
Cool.
So I have a little bit of that information. So they're primarily concentrated on the East and West Coast right now. So there are several in California, and then there's actually one in Texas, and then the others are kind of Florida, up through Pennsylvania, Kentucky, and kind of up into the Northeast. So unfortunately, if you're kind of middle of the country, you're in a little bit of a tougher spot and maybe having to haul a bit further. In terms of cost, it's very institution dependent. I would say, you know, it's an advanced imaging modality, so it's certainly kind of on a par with, you know, sort of like a CT or MRI kind of price. Yeah, so it is something that can be cost prohibitive.
And are there certain anatomic regions or type of injuries where you think PET scan is particularly advantageous?
I think it has advantages kind of everywhere. I think the area that people have really focused on is actually the fetlock of racehorses. And so that was kind of an initial area of focus because we know that racehorses are predisposed because of how they exercise and work. They're predisposed to developing particular types of injury, which can kind of fester until they result in like a catastrophic injury, right? And we, you know, are all, I think, super concerned about the welfare of racehorses and wanting to make sure that, you know, we keep those horses as healthy as we can. And so part of that is, can we detect those injuries before they get to a point where the horse is going to be severely injured? So that was really a big focus of this, of the PET scan initially, because the other thing that the PET scan is good at is detecting some of those what we call prodromal changes in the bone. Because they are concentrated in areas of bone turnover, they can show you this, that the bone is remodeling before there's actually structural abnormality in the bone. So if you did if you took x-rays or did a CT scan, you might actually not see those changes because it hasn't got to the point of structural change, but there might be increased uptake on the PET scan, kind of letting you know, hey, this is an area that we need to watch and be careful of. So I think that's an area where PET has really shone and has really contributed a lot to equine welfare, and in particular, racehorse welfare.
Yeah. Yeah, I've read a lot about that. So is there any other advice that you would give for vets interested in maybe incorporating this diagnostic modality into their toolkit or into their referral process, or anything else that you would add about this case?
I would say get to know the radiologists that are involved with your local PET scan, if you're lucky to have one close by to you, because they will be a great resource in terms of helping you with that case selection and letting you know what would or wouldn't be a good candidate. One other thing that I didn't mention is that usually we do try to combine the PET scan with a structural modality. So we'll oftentimes do it in conjunction with a CT or an MRI. And then what we can do is we can actually fuse those images together. And so we can kind of put the whole piece together where we say, oh, you know, that area of increased signal on the MRI is associated with a focal point of uptake on the PET scan. Or conversely, like I said, you might say, oh, this area is hot on the PET scan, but we don't have a structural abnormality on the CT. And that's helpful because even though the PET scan is 3D and gives us good images, it can be a little bit challenging to perfectly localize those areas of uptake without kind of superimposing it with something that has a little bit more anatomical detail. So you also kind of want to talk to the radiologist about, okay, what other imaging has been done or can be done so that we can kind of put all of those pieces together. And then, of course, unfortunately, that does kind of further increase the cost as well when you're then sort of layering multiple modalities in place. But sometimes it can also work that like the horse has a prior CT from another institution or, you know, went for an MRI somewhere else, and we can kind of work together with pre-existing studies as well to give that complete picture.
Right. Well, is there anything else that you would like to share with our audience before we go?
I don't think so. Thank you so much for having me today and giving me the opportunity to give a little bit of an intro to PET. There's definitely plenty of other cases where it can be really helpful. So like I say, just reaching out to your friendly neighborhood radiologist. We're always happy to chat and consult on these cases. And the more we do, the more information we get from this, you know, quite new modality, and that benefits all of us and benefits all of our patients. So happy to talk about these cases.
Yeah, we really appreciate you coming on, Dr. Acutt, to share this case and give us some more insight into this imaging modality. So thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode of Daily Vet Life. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks to DECRA for their support.